As I said in my summary of this book, what we had were clusters of village groups, you know, that were to a great extent autonomous and felt independent of each other. You know, it was colonialism that first and foremost, you know, started referring to, you know, language groups, you know, as a single entity. You know, prior to these groups, you had a multiplicity of villages, you know, within a particular language group, and every village felt autonomous of all the other villages, you know, and they cooperated only as the need arose. And of course, they also went to war among themselves, even though they spoke the same language. It was the very first time, you know, these village groups, you know, that spoke the same language, you know, started being referred to as, you know, one group, one tribe, or one ethnic group, you know, was really at the point of colonialism, you know, because colonialism and the introduction of the capitalist relations of production, you know, brought with them the phenomenon of scarcity of values in the economy. In the traditional setup, you know, there was no question of a member of the village, you know, who going hungry, you know, for a day. It was not possible. The traditional African society was able, you know, to provide, you know, food, you know, for all the members of the village. The traditional society also was able to provide housing. There was no question of homelessness, you know, but with the introduction of capitalist relations of production and the scarcity of values that it engendered, you know, it now became imperative, you know, for all the village groups, the clusters of village groups, you know, that spoke the same language, you know, to begin to band together, you know, as one, you know, because with the new capitalist relations of production, you know, and the scarcity that it has brought, there was now a climate of competition among the various, you know, social groups and component units of these nation states. You know, so the consciousness of tribe and ethnic group, the way we know them today, it was at this point that it took root, you know, because there was now an advantage, you know, in being in large numbers. You know, so these otherwise independent and autonomous village groups started coming together, you know, for the purposes of the competition, you know, with the other language groups, you know, that also existed. It was this singular act that actually galvanized the village groups into the tribes and ethnic groups that we know today on the African continent. You know. So, what I've said in effect is that, save for those African societies that had actually gotten to the point of feudalism, you know, prior to the coming of colonialism and the introduction of the state system and capitalism on the African continent, you know, a vast majority of traditional African society, you know, was essentially organized along, you know, village lines, and these villages felt autonomous, and even where several villages spoke the same language, they did not see themselves as one, and the consciousness, you know, having to band together, and in order to be able to compete, you know, with the other groups, you know, did not arise. You know, but capitalism and the state system, you know, which colonialism introduced, you know, succeeded in doing this. And that was how the phenomenon of tribes and ethnic groups, in the way we know them today, arose in different parts of Africa. It is also important in trying to understand, you know, the various problems and the difficulties on the African continent, you know, to also look at, you know, how the African society, you know, was incorporated into the global capitalist system. Prior to the coming of colonialism, you know, they existed, you know, pre-existing pre-capitalist relations of production and modes of organizing society, which I had talked about and which I referred to as African communalism. You know, but with the coming of colonialism now, you know, through the instrumentality of trade, investment, the activities of multinational corporations, you know, the colonial states, you know, gradually started integrating the African economies into the global capitalist system, you know. And as these relations intensified, you know, African economies gradually became, you know, an integral part of the global capitalist system. Integral part in the sense that they were not equal. The African economies, you know, were not actually operating on equal footing, you know, with the global capitalist system. The African economies became appendages, you know, or peripheral components of the global capitalist system. You know, the colonialists, what they did was to introduce, you know, the phenomenon of cash crop. You know, before colonialism, African farmers essentially farmed and produced what they ate and what they needed. You know, but as colonialism came and the integration of these economies into the global capitalist system, you know, intensified, it became necessary for African farmers, you know, to produce those crops, you know, which they did not actually need or which they did not actually use by themselves. They now started producing for the external market. You know, that was how, you know, the production of things like coffee, cocoa, and all the other, you know, cash crops, granite, palm oil, you know, became intensified over and above the needs, the actual needs, you know, of these societies. What capitalism did essentially, you know, was to create a market in the metropoles, you know, that in different ways continue to service, you know, the needs of the global capitalist system. And at the point of independence for African states, you know, this very structure, you know, continue to exist. And that was what, you know, the indigenous bourgeoisie and the political elite in Africa that took over power from the colonialists inherited. And it wasn't so long, you know, before this political elite, you know, ran into trouble and the African economies became highly unstable, you know, because they became very much susceptible to the vagaries and trends in the global capitalist system. So that anything that affected the global capitalist system, you know, automatically affected these economies in Africa. And because these economies are not autonomous on their own, they are integral, you know, appendages of the global capitalist system. The effects of the crisis in the global capitalist system, in fact, tends to affect, you know, these appendages much more than the mainstream capitalist economies. So these, I'm just trying to establish the roots, you know, of the crisis and difficulties, you know, we have on the African continent. And no sooner than the political elite that took over power after independence in Africa, entered office, you know, then severe economic crisis, you know, overtook the whole of the African continent. And by the 1980s, the severity of this economic crisis was such, you know, that African states, African economies could no longer cope. And a second phase of the integration of African economies into the global capitalist system, you know, now ensued. The IMF and the World Bank, you know, came together and put up a program of structural adjustment, you know, and sold it. They were able to sell this remedy or this therapy, you know, to African countries. What the program of structural adjustment, you know, essentially involves are deregulation of the economy, trade liberalization, you know, devaluation of the currency, removal of, you know, social subsidies, and increased, you know, defense spending and opening up of the market, you know, for capital and multinational corporations to really be able, you know, to penetrate the these African economies, you know, more and more. And by the mid-1980s, you know, close to 36 or more African states, you know, were already implementing the structural adjustment program. And it is more than 15 years, you know, since SAP was introduced on the African continent. And one might want to ask, you know, what has been the impact of the structural adjustment on African economies? The impact, you know, generally speaking, you know, has been negative. You know, the structural adjustment program has proved, you know, most incapable of addressing the problem, the economic problems, you know, which African countries face. In most cases, it has either reinforced these problems or, in fact, exacerbated them. And today, virtually every African economy, you know, is in deep and serious crisis. You know, there is massive unemployment. You know, the unemployment levels in some of the African countries are as much as 50%, if not more. There's a creeping inflation. The national currencies of most African states have become worthless. Social utilities, social services, and social infrastructure, you know, are decaying. And in the midst of all this, you know, Africa has been able to accumulate, you know, massive external debt, you know, which they cannot handle. A country like Nigeria, you know, owes about $40 billion, you know, to Western creditor nations, Western financial institutions, notably the IMF and the World Bank. And every year, the country spends about 30 to 40% of our annual budget on servicing the external debt alone, you know. What we are experiencing in Africa today is actually, you know, net transfers of resources from the otherwise impoverished African economies, you know, to the West, you know, through this process of debt servicing, you know. You know, the truth is that the debts of the African, the debts, the external debts owed by most of these African countries cannot actually be repaid, you know, because the capacities of African economies are such that these debts cannot be repaid. Two, it is also possible that these countries have ended up transferring even more resources, you know, than the principal sum, you know, which they actually borrowed originally. And to that extent, again, you know, the process of debt servicing, you know, is a vicious cycle, you know, which the African countries can never really, you know, come out of, you know, except something drastic is done. And worst of all is that the African political elite themselves, you know, lack the political will, you know, to be able to come together and repudiate these debts, you know, because that, you know, to my mind, is the most sensible thing to do, you know. But because the political elite in Africa are actually clients and middlemen, you know, for Western governments and multinational corporations, you know, they lack, you know, the nationalism and the political will, you know, to be able to do this. Related to the phenomenon of external debt is, of course, the question of corruption, you know, that has arisen on the African continent. You see, because the political elite, you know, which to whom the colonialists handed over power, you know, does not have a strong base of their own, you know, just as the economies of African states, you know, became appendages and peripheral attachments, you know, to the Western economies, so also the political elite in Africa, you know, became middlemen, you know, and fronts, you know, for Western multinational corporations and Western governments alike. So that if you want to understand, you know, the gravity of corruption on the African continent, you know, you have to understand that there is a trinity between the political leadership on the African continent, the multinational corporations, and the Western governments. Corruption is probably, you know, the biggest industry on the African continent today, and the way it operates is a very, you know, complex network. We found that there are leaders on the African continent, a lot of them, who are actually richer, you know, than their countries, than their respective countries. You know, the late Mobutu, you know, at a point, was richer than Zaire. And yet, Zaire, at the point of independence, was supposed to be one of the richest countries in Africa because it virtually has every mineral resource you can think of in this world. You know, but Mobutu, acting in complicity with the multinational corporations and with the backing of several Western countries, you know, has been able to run the economy of Zaire aground. So that today, Zaire, even by African standards, is one of the poorest countries in Africa. You know, another typical example is, of course, Nigeria. You know, where Nigeria, you know, by her size, stature, and natural and human resources, should not be a poor country today. You know, Nigeria should actually be at the level of countries like Malaysia and South Korea, you know, today, you know, because there is virtually no natural resource Nigeria does not have. In fact, apart from the fact that Nigeria is the sixth largest OPEC producer and produces close to 2.1 million barrels of oil per day and earns about $10 billion from oil alone, you know, every year, you know, Nigeria has, in fact, even more reserves of gas than oil and a lot of other mineral, solid mineral resources. And Nigeria has, you know, one of the highest, in fact, has the highest, you know, human resources on the African continent, even much more than South Africa. You know, there are at least about 4,000 Nigerian medical doctors in North America, you know, about the same number in Europe, and maybe another 1,000 in the Middle East, you know, and a lot of trained manpower, engineers, geologists who are in different parts of the world, and also academics, you know, in different American universities and different European universities. You know, because of the mismanagement and the corruption at home, you know, these people have been forced, you know, to leave the country, you know, and to seek, you know, greener pastures elsewhere. And it is not surprising that the former dictator, the late Nigerian dictator who died in June this year, you know, had within a period of 5 years accumulated about 3.6 billion pounds, you know, in foreign bank accounts. You know, it is to show you the kind of, you know, primitive accumulation, you know, that is going on in different parts of the African continent. You know, the point is that this primitive accumulation would not have been possible, you know, without, you know, the collaboration, in fact, the active participation of the multinational corporations that are all over Africa, you know, mining and exploring, drilling for oil and mining for solid minerals. You know, they act, you know, hand in gloves, you know, with these regimes, you know, to be able to expropriate Africa. The leaders, you know, take their own share, and the multinational corporations take their own. And most of these monies are actually lodged in Western banks, you know, and it is not as if the as if Western governments, you know, do not know about the lodgements of all these monies in Western banks, you know, but, you know, they wouldn't even go as far as trying to force these monies to be repatriated to the you know, countries where they came from, you know, because there is an unwritten code, you know, between the Western governments, the multinational corporations, and the political elite in Africa. And the people are being increasingly impoverished, you know, and there is widespread poverty, you know, misery, and every day we read about epidemic diseases all over Africa. It is, you know, this expropriation of African wealth, you know, in the hands of the political leadership, the multinational corporations, and the Western governments. And in different parts of Africa, you know, this crippling poverty, you know, of the ordinary people, you know, plays a central role in most of the crises and conflicts we have on the continent. I shall illustrate this with Nigeria, you know, because in the past 5 years, you know, there's been a serious uprising in different parts of the oil-producing areas in Nigeria. You know, the oil-producing areas are suffering a lot of untold hardship, you know. First and foremost, the environment and natural habitat, you know, have been devastated, you know, through the activities of multinational oil corporations, you know, led by Shell, you know, Chevron, Mobil, Agip, Elf, and all the rest. And the exploration activities of these multinational oil corporations have been intensified, you know, following the economic difficulties, you know, which the country, you know, found itself in. And it is also the same thing for other for different parts of Africa, you know, where you have natural resources. There is an intensification of, you know, mining activities in different parts of Africa because the government see this intensification as the only way, you know, they can make more money. And in the process of this intensification, the environment is being severely devastated. You know, that is one. Secondly, the people are being forced, you know, as a result of the devastation, you know, to leave their farmlands, leave their fishing occupation, you know, because the waters, the farmlands have been so devastated that the people can no longer fish, they can no longer farm. So there is, in fact, increasing unemployment. And among, you know, the youths, you know, who are leaving colleges and universities, you know, there is massive unemployment, you know. So it is the combination of all these factors, you know, that have galvanized the unemployed, the displaced peasants, in the different oil-producing communities and other parts of the country, you know, to really begin to take their own destiny in their own hands. Because several complaints and representations to government, you know, have not yielded anything. If anything, the government has responded, you know, with even greater and vicious repression. You know, in different parts of the oil-producing communities in Nigeria, there are actually troops, government troops, you know, the police, the army, you know, guarding, taking over the entire villages. And this, in my view, is in fact the worst form of internal colonialism, you know. And in perpetuating these repressive activities, you know, the Nigerian government has done this hand in glove with the multinational corporations. It has been proved beyond doubt, you know, in Nigeria, for instance, that Shell actually arms and sources ammunition for the Nigerian government, you know, is been proved, you know, beyond doubt. And I was just going through a recent documentary done by one or two American journalists who visited Nigeria. And in one portion of the interview with the Chevron managing director, the Chevron managing director actually admitted, you know, that they are in the habit of using, you know, Chevron helicopters, you know, to ferry security agencies and troops into the oil producing areas. And these are troops that enter these oil producing areas and massacre people. And most of these massacres and killings, you know, don't even get mentioned or heard anywhere, you know. In the face of the uprising in different parts of southern Nigeria, you know, the cause of this uprising is clearly speaking poverty and the frustration and disillusionment of the people, you know, with the government, with the activities of multinational corporations, and also with the international response. You know, the people are taking very dire risks, you know, at the risk of losing their own lives. And in one instance in Nigeria, the inhabitants of one small oil-producing community, you know, known as Jesse, you know, which has been sabotaging Shell operations and oil pipelines and equipment, there was an outbreak of fire in the neighborhood, and it killed more than 1,000 people. You know, it is a measure of the poverty and desperation in which the people in these areas find themselves. Because, you know, when the pipeline was sabotaged and fuel was gushing, they were scooping it, you know, with scooping the fuel with buckets, with bowls, and in the process, you know, the whole thing caught fire and killed as many as 1,000 people, you know, in the inferno. That is the situation in the oil producing areas of Nigeria. And this kind of uprising, we're also seeing it in other different parts of Africa. It's not just Nigeria. I'm just using Nigeria as a basis for illustration. You know, we have now come to the point, you know, where it has become very clear that the state system on the African continent, you know, has failed. You know, the state system has failed because it has not been able to deliver, you know, the commonest needs, you know, the most basic of needs of the ordinary people. Secondly, the state system has also failed the state system has also failed, you know, in mediating crises and conflicts among different social groups, you know, which we know as ethnic groups or tribes. You know, the state system is unable to mediate the conflict, you know, and the relationship among these various social groups, principally because the state system is not a neutral force. You know, it cannot rise above, you know, this conflict and be an impartial arbiter, you know, because it is itself an interested party, you know, in the crisis and conflicts that exist among the various social groups in Africa. You know, so this is, you know, what I have done is to provide you with a basic and fundamental understanding, you know, of how these problems have arisen, you know, over the years, so that you can now be able to picture, you know, developments and events, you know, on the African continent, and maybe gain deeper insight into how these problems arose and how they are developing. You know, as far as one can see, you know, most of the problems on the African continent are actually economic. You know, most of the problems are byproducts of most of the problems and the crises are byproducts of poverty. You know, there is widespread poverty on a scale that is not known in any part of the world, you know, on the African continent. And, you know, what, you know, many people actually see as being ethnic conflicts, as being tribal conflicts, are actually concrete economic difficulties and concrete, you know, expressions of economic needs and demands, you know, being made by African peoples on the state system, and the state system is unable to deliver on most of these demands. It's not able to also to be able to mediate a crisis and conflicts among the various social groups, you know, in the in these countries. You know, a classical case of the collapse of the state system on the African continent is, of course, a country like Somalia, you know, which in the past 7 years, you know, has not had a government. You know, instead, warlords have virtually partitioned Somalia into small empires of their own, which they administer and continue to run as they like. And to show you clearly that most of the problems on the African continent are not really, you know, tribal or ethnic, you know, Somalia is actually one of the few homogeneous countries on the African continent. Somalia is an entirely homogeneous country, and it has only one language, and all the populations in Somalia speak the same language. You know, but for 7 years, Somalia has remained without an effective, you know, government. You know, we have also seen this kind of scenario in Liberia. We've seen it in Sierra Leone too. You know, where for several years, you know, various governments there, you know, I mean, there was no effective government in these countries. You know, even in those African states, you know, where you have, you know, semblance of government, you still find out that, you know, large portions of the territories of these countries are actually under rebel occupation. You know, if you take countries like Angola, you know, since independence, you know, close to 40% of Angola has been under rebel occupation. That's the UNITA. If you take a country like the Sudan, you know, since the 1980s, the southern half of Sudan, you know, has been under rebel occupation. If you take the Congo, you know, a substantial part of the Congo today is under rebel occupation. If you take Mozambique, if you take Chad, and, you know, different other, you know, countries on the African continent, you see that the, you know, the this is the rule, you know, rather than the exception. You know, so you can clearly see, you know, that the state system on the African continent has collapsed. In fact, it has failed. And in the face of this crisis of the state system on the African continent, what, you know, the Western governments have been recommending to Africa is Western liberal democracy. You know, that is a situation whereby you hold periodic elections, maybe after every 4 or 5 years. You know, that this will go a long way in you know, restoring order, bringing about stability, you know, on the African continent. You know, of course, many African countries have you know, just like in the case of SAP, you know, bought, you know, this therapy, you know, being bandied about by the West, and in close to half, if not more, of African states, you know, today we have periodic elections, you know, holding every 4 years or 5 years, you know, but even if we look at, you know, the personnel involved in these elections, you can see that, you know, there is a lot to be desired, you know, in the whole process, because we've seen military rulers, you know, who suddenly transformed into civilian presidents, you know, being able to manipulate the electoral process, you know, to reproduce themselves, you know, over and over and over and over again, you know, in Togo, the Togolese president Yedema, you know, has been in power for now for more than 32 years, and the electoral system continues to reproduce him, you know. So the point I'm making is that Western liberal democracy, you know, is not a solution to, you know, the grave economic problems, you know, which Africa, several African countries face today, because the just like the state system itself, the Western liberal democracy is artificial. You know, it does not correspond to the reality on the ground in the African states. You know, because the Western liberal democratic experiments actually end up alienating the common people, you know, for whom, you know, these experiments are meant. You know, the common people are not, you know, honestly speaking, a part of this process. You know, it is a game of elite, you know, manipulation, you know, whereby the elite continues to reproduce itself, and the people, you know, continue to, you know, get poorer and poorer. Otherwise, you know, the Western liberal democratic experiment on the African continent should have started to address the concrete economic problems and the needs of the ordinary people on the African continent. You know, but we find out that even in those countries that have actually bought this therapy, the living standards and the quality of life in these countries have not improved one bit, you know, more than what they used to be. In several cases, in fact, the living standards have plummeted. If we look at a country like Zimbabwe, you know, the living standards, you know, have gone from bad to worse since 1980, you know, when the country gained independence. And again, one man has been ruling since 1980 till now, and somehow he's been able to manipulate the electoral process, you know, to achieve this kind of outcome. You know, so my point of contention is that periodic elections, you know, do not in any way, you know, present a solution, you know, to the grave economic problems which, you know, the African nations, African countries are facing today. Our own proposition is actually, you know, for a return, you know, to the African communal, you know, system of social organization, you know, which, in my opinion, you know, corresponds to the reality on the African continent. You know, the Western liberal democracy, as I said earlier, just like the state system itself, is artificial and remote, you know, from the ordinary African. It in fact ends up alienating, you know, a vast majority of the African population, you know, and does not incorporate them into the process of decision making and planning. You know, so my advocacy is actually for a return of a return to, you know, African communal ways of organization, of social organization, you know, so that the various communities, you know, will not only be independent and will not only offer equal access and opportunities, you know, to the citizens, they will of course take, you know, direct control over their natural resources and be able to use these natural resources for concrete economic development. This is one effective way of also holding the multinational oil corporations, both in oil and the mining sectors, accountable, you know, for the devastation of the environment, you know, which they are devastating in these communities. If the people are able, if the ordinary people are, take effective control of their resources, you know, the devastations and the activities of the multinational oil corporations you know, would be better checked. You know, because what we have on the African continent today is a situation where the center, there is so much centralization and concentration of powers, you know, in the hands of the government at the center. You know, Nigeria is a typical example. You know, even though Nigeria is supposed to be a federal state, we find out that there is absolute concentration and centralization of powers at the center, at the expense of the component, at the expense of the component units. You know, the government at the center, you know, appropriates all the resources and the powers, you know, to itself. And what it does is that it gives out handouts to the states and local councils. And these handouts are barely enough, you know, for the states and local councils to even begin to pay, you know, salaries of workers in the public sector, you know, before they can think of building roads, building schools, you know, building hospitals, and creating employment opportunities for the ordinary people. And worst of all is that the various governments at the center are actually very remote, you know, from the ordinary people. It is, you know, the ordinary people actually come in contact with governments at the level of the local councils and the states. You know, they do not come in contact with government at the level of the center, because the center is far removed from them, and very few people among the ordinary folks, you know, actually even get to go to the capital of the countries, you know, because you know, they do not even have the means, and their day-to-day activities are concentrated in their villages and rural settlements. You know, I mean, it's only contributes to the only ends up only contributing to the intensification of the crisis and conflicts on the African continent. In the case of a country like Nigeria, you know, the fact of military rule, the fact that out of 38 years of independence, the military has been in power for 30 years, has even gone a step further, you know, to worsen, you know, the structure of this centralization and concentration of powers at the center. You know, because the way the military works is such that, you know, the military does not delegate power, it does not delegate authority or responsibility in any way. You know, there is a hierarchical command and a hierarchical command structure, you know, which does not permit the sharing of responsibilities and sharing of duties and the delegation of powers. So, to round up and maybe take one or two, a couple of questions or comments, you know, from the House, I want to say that, you know, what Africa needs today, you know, is a political model, you know, that, you know, goes a long way, you know, to address the concrete economic needs, you know, of the African continent or the African peoples. The bottom line of most of the crises we have on the African continent is economic, namely poverty. And until we can devise, you know, a political model, you know, that can actually address, you know, these concrete economic problems of poverty, you know, it is my considered opinion that Western liberal, you know, democratic experiments being put together in different parts of Africa, you know, does not present a solution, you know, to the problems of the continent. Thank you.